So Megan chatted with me a couple months ago and asked if I would give a talk about embryo genotyping. And I said, you know, I'd be happy to. I don't have a lot of slides historically, but I've been around ART for most of my life. And we did a lot of these things a long time ago. And so it's funny how these things kind of come in circles, like research and technology. And the technology gets better, and so we try it again. And so I thought I'd put together a talk today, the last couple days, about the past, present, and future of embryo biopsy and leading to genotyping embryos. And so for those of you that saw my test yesterday, or my talk yesterday, I talked about some stuff that was pretty neat with like fetal cell lines and seven-day-old embryos and genotyping. And that really came about because of what we tried and we're trying to overcome with embryo biopsy as it relates to high-density genotyping. And we'll talk about that because those are the things that limit it. But embryo biopsy has a place and is being done. But there's also some things to think about as you go through it if you're going to utilize these technologies. And I'm going to show you some data that's kind of driven me to do some R&D things through the last 5 years that kind of keeping a pulse and then also working with the genotyping companies with these technologies and how far we can take it on a large mass scale. So this is not new. Biopsying embryos has been going on for a long, long time. And I went back to the literature and pulled the two first papers that really came out, and it was actually sexing embryos. This is in the early days. PCR, the actual reaction, polymerase chain reaction, that allowed us to amplify a region of the genome is only like 5 years older than these papers and actually come into existence in science. It's something we do all the time now and we take for granted, but in the mid-90s and that, it was a big, big deal if you got to do it school and graduate school, run polymerase chain reaction and amplify a region of the genome. And these were early deals. Some of you might know Brian Kirkpatrick at the University of Wisconsin. In the work that he's done through the years as an animal breeder in that. But these were the early papers and led to a lot of embryos that were biopsied and sexed through the actual 90s. So the main reasons that why would we biopsy an embryo and then do sorting before we transferred an embryo into a recipient female? Primarily what has driven that a lot of the time has been the cost of the recipient herd. Managing recipients like run on anything can be extremely expensive. And the more and more we run like in beef and run a recipient herd like a beef commercial cow herd, the more economical it is. The problem we always have is there's this lag of if we're running an extensive recipient herd and we're not going in and doing a set of transfers and coming in with cleanup bulls, we end up with a lot of head days, and our cost per pregnancy and stuff gets really, really high. So there's always this driving factor, and it's that way in beef, and it's that way in dairy industry also, is how do we, with ART, with transferring embryos, how do we decrease our recipient cost, our cost per calf? And everybody thinks about making embryos can be extremely expensive in that, but when we really add up our cost of calf production, if it's a cooperator herd where we're paying $2,000 a calf, it's our own herd, it's those open head days that always give us fits. It's not having that cow pregnant, she's not producing something, and the cows that get pregnant and have that ART calf have to account for those differences. And so when you call and you're getting ready to pay your recipient that you bought from Transova and you're complaining about the price, you have to remember that all of those pieces are going into it in the cost of and with maintaining. So the cows that come up open are also costing, have to be figured into that. Then we have often the values of the calves. So with sexing, it gets really interesting. In cases where people want a desired sex of a calf, let's sex the embryos and let's put in the females or let's put in the males and let's dump the others on the ground. And it can be an expensive way to make animals when you think about your cost of your embryo production, your cost of your biopsying and genotyping. So if we go back and look historically, and I was working with one of our vets who actually did lots and lots of biopsying all through the 90s and the early 2000s with his practice in Canada. Actually, at that time also, we did a lot of embryo splitting, making it more efficient. So these were the parameters and the things that were happening. Primarily, embryo sexing back in that day was being done, well, embryo biopsy was being done for sexing of embryos. But in the late 90s and early 2000s, Transova did offer embryo biopsying for sexing of embryos, and a lot of other reproductive groups around the U.S. or the U.S. and Canada also did. First thing is, when you flush a cow, and even back in the day, about 75% of the embryos were biopsiable. So in order to biopsy, which is something that you do that's intrusive to the embryo, you have to take the very best embryos and get cells out of that embryo. So that's always been a factor that has been a little bit of a limitation to people. You've got 10 embryos, you tell them that only 7 of them are we can only biopsy 7 of them and test them for sex. So I got these other 3 that we can't. Well, they're not of high enough quality to freeze. And so there's that mindset of, well, we need to put those in, so is it really worth doing? And that's a decision point thing that a person has to think about as they use these technologies. What we actually would do is we would go in and we would cut part of the zona off and take about 4 or 5 cells that we could use for polymerase chain reaction and actually run the assay that took a couple, 3 hours. And then we would run a gel and make the decision and decide which embryos were transferred and which ones would potentially be thrown away on that. On average, there was about a 10% failure rate. So of those, if we were doing 10 embryos, we'd have one of them that we biopsied and we would have an unsuccessful assay, and we're dealing with very small amounts of DNA with just having like 4 or 5 cells like that and making sure that those cells get in the reaction and everything happens. There's all these little places that humans can cause errors or the reaction fails, and we end up not achieving a genotype for that particular embryo. And so these embryos historically had to be transferred fresh. And so 2 to 4 hours, once you had that result, the embryos, then you made your decision, you transferred embryos. What they often saw was about a 5 to 10% decrease in preg rate. So we've done something that's a little intrusive to the embryo. We've decreased preg rate historically. So the embryos implanted, you have, if it was a sexed embryo like that, would utilize biopsy technology, you had about a 2x cost to produce because the embryos that you threw away, and you had about a 2x cost for each embryo with the test, because it's having to absorb the cost of the test you do with a slightly decreased preg rate. This practice was done quite a bit for quite a few years, off and on. The industry trends, what we found was, and what I was talking to some of the older vets as they were that had been doing it at Transova, was a handful of clients would start and really stick with it and really, really liked it. Because of some of these factors that we were just discussing, like what do we do with the other 25%? Well, these are really good genetics. We need to put them in. What? Defeating a little bit of the whole purpose of what they're trying to do. The viable embryos that were not, those 25% that were not, that could not be frozen. They needed to be transferred. So we couldn't even freeze and set them aside for a different time point. And getting to the cost embryo production impact on plague rate. So these cost, I call it cost-benefit decision models. Putting all these factors into them, making a decision. Does this technology fit what you're trying to do? Are you going to achieve the results that you need? And a change in, and big one that happened then in the early 2000s, around 2005, 2006, with the ability of sex semen, the technology becoming commercialized and getting better and better, that totally changed that portion of biopsying embryos for sexing. And actually, by 2005, it Transova Genetics and other companies had removed biopsy from their pricing sheets. So another way that, and then this kind of recycled back as we went through some things with defects in the in 08, 09, 010 in there and that, having embryos from a parent that was a specific carrier, maybe frozen, or wanting to make embryos from a parent that's a specific carrier, but really not wanting to gestate the embryos that could be carrying a genetic defect. And so biopsying, again, kind of gets a little boost. And something that's practical, utilizing those really good genetics and not having to throw them out and being able to do that and capture it with some embryos and all the things we talked about that were that kind of went through that mind thought process and the idea of how this all works and as we think through it. But has done and has worked with even some success and some reports out there where they have taken a frozen embryo and they know one of the parents is actually a carrier, thawed it, done the test, gone ahead and implanted the embryo, and when they got the test results back, then made a decision to go ahead and on the ones that came back as genotyped as a carrier, go ahead and just and abort the recipient. That's a really financially interesting one to model because you have a lot of cost, even if you're at 30, 40 days, and if you wait even farther out and wait for, like, we have a clients occasionally ask us to fetal ultrasound, and they would like to knock the pregnancies out of those recipients at 60 days. When you model that financially and the turnaround time on those cows and everything, we have to charge about 55, 60% of what that pregnant recip is going to cost them in order to justify doing that. And it's just and you, the numbers. You, by the time you get to a 60-day pregnancy with an embryo in it, you have tied up a lot of money in that female. So that's an option that a lot of times is not a... It really have to justify the expense of really wanting to do that. So as high-density chips and everything come along and we start talking about genomic-enhanced DPDs and we start looking at, wow, what if we could run these and what if we could do that? We could biopsy an embryo and get a genomic-enhanced genetic merit back, value back. This animal, this calf hasn't even existed, and start making some decisions about just putting in the highs or putting in a particular, we have an index or a group of traits, whatever it is that we're trying to do. So all of us started thinking about this, but also understanding kind of some of the challenges of manipulating these embryos, of doing these things that are intrusive to these embryos. There was a paper that a lot of you know John Williams that has done some great animal genetics work through the years. His group published in 2013 and actually started looking at different kits and started looking at amount of cells from biopsies that are needed to try and get high-quality DNA information for running high-density chips. And what we know is when we run PCR, we take a handful of cells. We just need just a snippet of DNA, right? Because we're making copies of this region of the genome with a little, we're targeting in on a little small region, and it's like a Xerox copy machine. We flank that region with some little chunks of DNA, and we just run off copies. And that's what polymerase does. It makes all these copies of it, and makes enough of it that we can see it and identify it in the gel. But when you get to a high density chip, we've got to start with a lot more starting material. We've got to have a lot more DNA. It's not a huge amount, like going way back to the early days of the molecular biology and what us molecular geneticists did years and years ago, the amount of DNA that we needed, but it's still significantly more than a single reaction just for like a simple sexing PCR. So we understand that we can take small amounts of DNA and we can do whole genome amplification. So making big copies, big long chunk copies of the genome with some different enzymes. But there's some things that come up and when doing this that get very interesting when we think of the accuracy of the information that we're getting. And so that's what these were two of the early papers over the last like 5-6 years. The first one was looking at types of biopsy, was looking at numbers of cells of starting material DNA for this WGA, going through the whole process. The second paper that came out in 2014 did a lot of this, but actually found that there were some key things with error rates in that just had to be fixed. And so at the same time, we were sitting and thinking about it. So we know now that we have to have, for high-density genotyping with the genomic chips, we have to do this whole genome amplification. Freeze, and we're going to have to then. So before I talked about a 2 to 4 hour lag, we do PCR with a simple sexing test with that biopsy DNA, and we turn around, and in 2 to 4 hours, we have a result. Well, when we start doing high-density genotyping on Illumina-based chips, this is a 2 to 3 day process from when we start with the DNA to when we actually have a readable genotype. Then we have to submit all this data, 50, 60,000 genotypes, 10,000 if it's a reduced that they're imputing up from. We've got to submit this to our genetic evaluation or some type of pipeline to get our genomic enhanced information back and then make that decision. So there's a lag. So we know we're going to have to freeze these embryos. We can't have them sitting around fresh for quite a number of days when you think about that process. So when you talk to the genetic companies in dairy, and we have discussions about doing this on with their nucleus programs, 30-40 day turnarounds from start to finish become a number that it needs to hit. So this whole turnaround thing of the speed at which they're going becomes very important. And the big one is then pregnancy rates that are not compromised too much. And this one is huge. So we've done a biopsy on an embryo, so we've done something that's intrusive to that little embryo when it's fresh, and we know that decreases preg rates. Now we're going to freeze that embryo, then eventually make a decision of which ones go in at some later point in time. And that's where we do a fair amount of work through the years and try and get a feel for that. But for anybody that's done a lot of embryo transfer work and transfers a lot of embryos, even when things are really, really good, that average you might average 50-55%, but in that year that you averaged 50-55%, say with your IVF fresh and frozen embryos, you might have had a preg check on 100 head that was at 30%, and you might have had one that was at 70%. And that variation, so there's this natural variation that's going on when things are even working really well, and then we've done something that's going to potentially decrease that. So I was doing a project when Intrexon bought Transova. This is coming on 5 years ago for Intrexon. And we were aspirating a group of females each week. And some treatments that we were doing. So we're fertilizing all the females to the same bull. These females were all Angus cows that were from a commercial herd back east. But we were pooling all their oocytes together because we had some treatment things we were doing. So I needed to understand to make the parentage of what was going on with our oocytes. We knew we had the same sire, but we wanted to understand, sort the embryos out after the fact of the what female that came from and the way this whole kind of experiment worked. And so I stumbled across this by chance. I kind of knew it a little bit, but I was really intrigued when I started seeing the data. So these are three females that we biopsied. So we'd get the oocyte, we'd fertilize it day 5, 6, or 7 based on the embryos, because we were trying to biopsy as many of the embryos as possible in this experiment, which is another thing from a management perspective and maximizing the number of embryos you biopsy that can be done. We were then taking those handful of cells and freezing the embryos and then running a whole genome amplification and submitting that for parentage. And we were utilizing at that time, we were doing simple parentage. This would have been the 96 SNP panel, and it was a sequenome-based technology. So that's a PCR-based technology. So we're doing an amplification. Well, I would get the data back, and if you look at the lines that are in blue, that's the biopsy. The call rate is 77 out of a total of 96 on this first animal that we're looking at here. And I'm running simple parentage, which is based on exclusions, you know, maybe one, a poor quality marker, but when it hits two. But I know all my cows that are in these pools. And I'm seeing these cows that are at like 2 and 3 exclusions. And every other cow in there is at 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 exclusions, which means there is no way, there is no other cow in there. And I start seeing this, and I'm seeing this over and over. Occasionally, one exclusion. Some of them are 0 exclusions. But I'm seeing this, and I'm like, okay, what's going on? So three of the older pregnancies that we had created, we did a fetal removal when they were at about 60, 70, 80 days of age. And so we go in and we actually do a surgery and we remove a fetus. Well, with that fetus, now we can extract really high quality DNA and we can get lots of it. So we extract DNA, send it off to the genotyping company, get it back, boom, 95 markers. That's the first line there, like on 117. 95 markers out of 96. We've got nice quality to get a good genotype. No dam exclusions. So when we started looking at this, now I have something I can compare the biopsy genotype information to what would have been like the calf. Well, you start seeing, see the disconcordance. That's where it didn't match. And this is on 96 markers. So this got my mind going a little bit. That animal was 77. Now, when that assay used to drop below like a threshold of 80 or of 80, the quality of the marker information and would fall off. And usually there was a cutoff. But even on these others that are at 85 and 89, you're talking 11, 10. Those should be exact matches if everything is great. So something's going on, and it's the whole genome amplification. So this led to me thinking about another experiment that we can do, and we've continued to do these with both the genotyping companies through the years as we've optimized these different whole genome amplifications kits, trying to find what gives us the best quality data. But we have the ability with all the cloning that we do, we make a cell line on an animal. So we take a chunk of skin, usually from an ear, but any tissue, and we can grow up millions of cells make from that little chunk of tissue of that animal. So what we do is we'll grow up a cell line for 10 days, 2 weeks, millions of cells, and we'll package those up in little tubes and freeze that away and utilize that for cloning at some point in time. So we can take one of those tubes, like I talked about yesterday, and extract high-quality DNA from it and get lots and lots of it. So it's just like having a good tissue sample from a calf, but in that case, but not have to have the calf. What we do is I like to create what I call fake biopsies. So we go in, and with those thawed cells, we can take and start doing optimization numbers. But with a whole genome amplification, you need to be somewhere around 10 or 12 cells minimum, which is quite a few cells when you start taking 10 or 12 cells out of a 6 or 7 day old embryo. But we create fake biopsies, and we can create multiple replicates of that with that same animal. So I make three. So like 1RF, 2RF, and 3RF are 10 to 12 cells each that each go into their own whole genome amplification reaction with the same kit being used. That generates enough DNA that then we can submit that DNA for genotyping. But at the same time, we can submit the 1R control, which is a whole big tube of cells that we've extracted with no genome amplification, great quality DNA, and then we can start doing comparisons and seeing what these error rates are and how much fallout we're having with the whole genome amplification. And this is fun data to look at. When you start looking across, you can see the call rate of 87%, 90%, and 89%. So those are identical starting material with the whole genome amplification. This chip that was being used at that time had about 67,000 SNPs on it that worked in bovine. The control, you can see a 99% call rate there. That's the 66,721. So there was, with each of these animals where we had comparable genotypes, there's 57,000 the first animal we could compare to the control, 60,000 and 60,000. So you start looking at the number that are correct. These should be identical. They should match in line and be the same. And then we start looking at the number of actual errors. So here's total errors. These are of genotypes that score and actually get called a quality genotype. And you can see those error rates. And it actually, with call rate, you see that pattern of the number of errors that are made. Then the big one is the amount of missing genotypes that we do. So when we start looking at these numbers, you know, we're well over over 11,000 missing or error genotypes in that first animal. So this creates a little bit of a conundrum as far as if we're going to submit these genotypes to go into a pipeline to get a high-density genomic-enhanced genetic evaluation back on. And so the problem is most of the pipelines are set up with the quality checks and stuff, and in dairy built this years and years ago, actually to keep, it would find crossbred animals, but there's a certain number of quality things that have to go through. These will not go through the pipeline. And of course, with this kind of error rate and stuff, you're really not sure what you're generating. And what we found is you find these patterns, and so the lower is just a breakdown of what we were seeing for number of correct heterozygotes, number of correct homozygotes, homo errors, which means it's a heterozygote and it's turned into a homozygous genotype, or a homo het error, which is the opposite, so it started as a homozygous that turned into a heterozygote. But what was incredible to me, and I didn't expect when we started doing these, was the opposite, complete homo-homo opposite errors, that those amplification making a complete mistake in creating a genotype at that location, instead of being GG, it was TT. And it's a small number, and it happened in two of those three, but it's still enough that kind of surprising in that. So this right away started confirming that if you're going to use biopsy and do whole genome amplification, we have got to set up and do parental imputation correction. And it's going to have to be part of it. So imputation and probably population with parental, meaning that you're going to have genotypes on the sire and dam in order to get get accurate information. So as this confirmed this, and we start looking at, and it confirmed the paper that was published in 2014. They did the same thing. They did set up a parental correction pipeline. We've done this and been working with one of the companies through the years on this and that. Occasionally, we see some things come through the parental imputation correction pipeline that something will be a little bit off being able to use these cells that we would use for cloning, these cells from these cell lines with this fake biopsy replication approach to validate what we're doing. We don't have to wait to get a calf. We can take and get high-quality DNA and then make our fake biopsies, but we can make identical copies and start looking at repeatability of results as we run these things through these pipelines. So interestingly, as we look at what's happened with high-density genotyping in dairy, the Canadian Embryo Transfer Association reports all these different types of embryo work and embryo stuff that was done. And 4 years ago, there was about 600 embryos that were genomically tested in Canada. Those were the embryos that they got a successful genotype with and ran through the evaluation pipeline. In the last 2 years, that's been less than 200. So there's been some uptake. So uptake and cost, and so you start looking at these things. We start talking, and IVF embryos are being done at such a large scale right now, and we start thinking about utilizing and genotyping embryos. 75% in vivo is what we used to do to biopsy. What we see is probably 60 to 75% of the embryos that get produced from an ovum pickup with a cow can be biopsied with a WGA getting a high density set of genotypes, and so it's a little bit less. What we did some large trials, and we did trials with biopsied in vivo embryos that then we froze the embryos and submitted the genotyping and worked on all of that, and then went and transferred those embryos. We did about close to 100 in vivo. We did close to 100 IVF embryos. And what we would see based on weeks and groups and comparing it to what was going, we see a 5 to 15% drop from like our frozen IVF embryo preg rates as it is. So it's a little more intrusive. We're doing a biopsy. We're taking a few more cells than we used to. And we're utilizing, and there's some different methods of biopsying, but we're using needle biopsies, which is sound to be about as least intrusive as we can. And when we do the micromanipulators and use a needle biopsy, it's the cloning teams that we have around and their ability to put a cell in a cell, a nucleus, and remove cells like that. So we're trying to be as the least amount intrusive as possible. And we see these kind of ranges then in our preg rates with our frozen biopsied embryos. We start thinking about and we start modeling it, and the reason we haven't gone in our nucleus populations that we own and started scaling this up for commercial production is when we start mapping out costs. So you've got a $40 genomic test, We've got $50 in freezing that embryo. We've got somewhere between, we'd have to charge somewhere between $50 and $80 for the biopsy, and the whole genome amplification fits into that, and it's a fairly expensive. And so when we put all this together and look at our cost per embryo, based on the recipient system that we're in and what we have access to, it doesn't model out for us right now. Now, that's not to say that there are other situations and systems where it does make a lot of sense, but the in our dairy nucleus populations, the hits, as you like to call it, of getting those really high animals is based on how many live calves can we get born. And so when we start sorting down and just putting in a group of high embryos and you start looking at preg rates, your probability of hits, we keep coming back to for us in our situation, is to put those embryos in either fresh or frozen without a biopsy and roll that way. And this really has pushed us to utilize these cell line systems that we're doing with fetal and seven-day-old embryos and genotyping them that way and not having to do an amplification and pipelines and all of that. So that's current status of where that technology is right now and where it's going. There's been some kit changes in the last few years, and right now they're being used primarily in human IVF, and there have been some improvements. When we did our initial stuff 4 and 5 years ago, the kits that everybody seems to be using for bovine embryo biopsy, and it's come to the top for everybody, the single-cell kit that you're using, is economically affordable. We have gone and looked at one of the human that's being used in human IVF, but right now the cost per assay or per embryo is high enough. We're not ready to go there. It looks like the call rates are slightly better, which means the error rates have probably improved dramatically. And we haven't ran that data yet, but I'm curious to actually do that and take a look at that with some large numbers. And with that, I'd be happy to entertain any questions.